The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Coral W. Peach presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. This is Judge Peach, and I'm joined by Judge Greenberg and Judge Toth. We are convened today via telephone conference to consider the arguments in the matter of Gary Philbrook versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 18-5628. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please make your appearance for our record.
Thank you, Your Honor. Kenneth Carpenter, appearing on behalf of Mr. Philbrook, also appearing as Glenda Hurl.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chandra Kelly on behalf of the Secretary, and with me is my deputy, Nicole Cottle.
Thank you. Does appellant's counsel wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes, please.
10 minutes? Okay, thank you. If counsel are ready, let's begin with appellant's counsel. Mr. Carpenter, please proceed.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Philbrook. As a preliminary matter, Your Honor, this morning we discovered some supplemental authority, which I would like to discuss this morning. I disclosed that authority in the conference to the government, and I will be submitting it in the formal pleading fashion as required by rule. That supplement authority comes from the Oregon State Statute. The state statute number is 13-502, and the two relevant subsections are subsection capital D and capital E. In subsection D, it discusses what happens if a finder of fact concludes that a defendant doesn't meet the requirements of the plea or the assertion of being guilty but insane. And E specifically says that a guilty except insane verdict is not a criminal conviction for sentencing enhancement purposes under sections 13-703 or 13-704. This does not address the question of whether or not a criminal conviction occurs. It only creates an exception in the statute. I've not been able to find anything directly on point as to whether or not such a unusual plea or finding does or does not constitute a criminal conviction.
This is Judge Greenberg.
Judge Greenberg, you go ahead.
How is this relevant, Mr. Carpenter, to the issue we have before us today? We're interpreting a federal statute.
I agree, Your Honor. It goes to the government's position that they can rely upon Oregon state statutes for the definition of a correctional facility, and it goes to the question of whether or not, as a matter of law, Mr. Philbrook was or was not convicted of a felony when the plea was accepted by the state court for his guilty except insane.
Thank you.
Judge Toth, did you have a question?
You know, I had largely the same question, which is, you know, obviously we're interpreting a federal statute. And so I guess as a follow-up, I mean, to what degree are any of the Oregon laws or definitions even relevant?
I'm not sure they are, Your Honor, except to the extent that they may or may not have persuasive value to this court. I suppose it would be treated comparably to a non-precedential opinion or authority from a non-binding jurisdiction. Mr. Philbrook's position is that the board's finding of fact that he had been incarcerated for a felony since October 2009, which is at the record at page 4, is a clearly erroneous finding of fact because there is no support for that finding of fact in the record. The record does not support that he was incarcerated. The record does not support that he was even convicted of a felony.
I apologize for interrupting, but yeah, that would largely depend on the definition of the term incarcerated, right? I mean, for instance,
yes, Your Honor, that is correct. Only to the extent that the term incarcerated would have to be interpreted as including commitment to a state mental hospital. Also, it would turn on the question of whether or not the resulting proceedings in the state of Oregon were or were not proceedings that were resulted in a conviction of a felon.
Okay, so I think one thing that might be helpful is, I'm looking at a case called Mulder. I don't know if you're aware of it. It's a Federal Circuit case from 2015, and it's looking at 5313. And it basically, I mean, it's interpreting it for a different provision, for sort of a timeliness provision, but it breaks it down, 5313, into four elements. I think they're somewhat helpful here. So the first is incarceration at a penal institution, right?
Right.
And so am I correct in understanding that you believe that under the plain language of that term, that it should be defined in such a way that it doesn't include what happened to Mr. Philbrook here?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, is it also, now the 60 days, the second element's irrelevant here. The third, do you believe that he was convicted? Are you challenging that?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Okay. And then obviously the fourth, felony.
And I am contesting it from the point of view that there is nothing in the record before the board, the record before the agency, that substantiates a determination, a factual determination, that he was in fact convicted of a felony.
But I mean, he pleaded, I mean, he stipulated to, he entered a plea, right?
He did, Your Honor, and he entered a plea of guilty. And if I could, this is exactly where I was going next.
Sure.
The record contains at pages 797 to 799 the judgment upon stipulation and finding of guilty except for insanity. This stipulation provides several relevant facts pertinent to this matter. First, it finds that the defendant committed acts alleged in count one to constitute the crime of murder. That is at page 797 of the record. It does not say that the defendant was found to have that those crimes resulted in a conviction as a result of the plea. Second, stipulation says at the next page, 798, that as a result of a mental disease or defect at the time of engaging in the criminal conduct, the defendant lacked substantial capacity either to appreciate the criminality of his conduct or to conform his conduct to the requirements of law. As a result, we have a clear finding of fact that the veteran in this case lacked the legal capacity to understand and appreciate the nature of his acts. Number three, at the same page, the defendant would have been found guilty of a Class A felony. That is a conditional statement and not a definitive statement. And then it describes what the Class A felony would have been based upon a serious physical injury or risk of serious physical injury to the victim in this case. And finally, and we believe most importantly, the order concludes that because of the defendant's mental disease or defect and the serious injuries which resulted from the defendant's actions, as well as the use of a dangerous weapon in the defendant's assault, he represents a substantial danger to others, requiring commitment to a state hospital, and is not the proper subject for conditional release into the community. It is clear
but
the...
It, but I'm sorry, sorry to, slow you down here, but I mean, did the judge also have to determine a term of sentence? I mean, a term that he would spend in this Oregon facility?
Yes, Your Honor. Under Oregon state law, the term is equivalent to what would have been the term had he been convicted and incarcerated.
Right, and that's different from like an involuntary confinement, right? I mean, if he had like a mental episode and was deemed a harm to others, right? I mean, he would be...
I'm not so sure about that, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to speak over you. Excuse me.
No, I mean, I'm ad-libbing, but the sense would be, I think once you sort of deem that you're no longer a threat to society, you're allowed to leave. Whereas here, I mean, there is, in a sense, something approximating a sentence passed on the Mr. Philbrook.
Well, Your Honor, it really goes to the final order of the court, which is at page 799, which placed Mr. Philbrook under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board for Mr. Philbrook's care, custody, and treatment for a maximum period not to exceed 20 years. This is a circumstance under the unusual nature of this state statute in
which
right,
but
state...
and again, so, sorry to keep interrupting you, but
okay.
If I'm correct in understanding how that works, like say a month later, that whatever board would have found him, you know, no longer or sane, or what, he would then be tried for the crime, right? I mean, he would go back and be rearraigned.
No,
am I wrong about that?
No, that is incorrect, Your Honor. In this case, and again, contrary to the finding of fact made by the board, this crime was committed in 2009, and he was in the state mental institution for competency determination until he was able to be deemed competent and made his plea. Under this statutory scheme, the state of Oregon has decided that a person who is insane at the time of the commission of a criminal act will be subject to commitment to this state board for the period of their sentence. And that commitment can be both outpatient as well as inpatient. And in the stipulation, it specifically indicates that his condition was such that he was not able to be released because of the seriousness of his condition, that he could have been released at that time. And in fact, what happened in this case was that he was committed for an extended period of time, had a brief period of release, was under the supervision of this state authority, was put back into the hospital until his release in
2018.
In 2018. Thank you, Ronan. That allowed him then to go to a supervised facility under this board's authority. And as I understand the state law, the board has the authority to return him to the state hospital should his condition deteriorate. And that...
If I may, Mr. Carpenter,
yes,
this is Judge Greenberg. Sorry to interrupt, but aren't we being asked to interpret a federal statute, and the focal point for our purposes is incarceration? He wasn't free to leave. This all arose out of an alleged criminal act, and aside from all the Oregon statutes and how Oregon decides to treat people such as this veteran, aren't we being asked in this case, or shouldn't we interpret what Congress meant by this statute? The way I look at it, maybe you can answer this question, if you combine the plain meaning of the statute with what Representative Montgomery had to say about it, aren't we really talking about when you're incarcerated and all your otherwise compensable activities are attended to by the state, why should the taxpayers pay twice?
Well, Your Honor, there are several responses to that question. The first is that I believe that Congress has recognized a distinction between incarceration for the conviction of a felony and incarceration in specifically identified institutions, penal institutions, correctional facilities that are not mental health facilities, and that the mental health facility, if, as Judge Toth alluded to in one of his earlier questions, if he had been civilly committed, then this statute certainly would not come into play, because he would simply have been involuntarily committed to a hospital for care and treatment. That is what happened here. Those are the facts of the record. If the interpretation should rest solely upon the plain meaning of the statute without going to the legislative history, unless there is some ambiguity about the meaning of those terms. And I would suggest that incarceration in a penal facility or correctional facility has a ordinary and plain meaning that is understood by any individual to mean that they are in a state or local facility that incarcerates convicted felons. This gentleman, there is no evidence of record that he is a convicted felon. He has pled guilty under a state statute except for insanity. And the legal consequence in the only evidence of record, the judgment upon stipulation, is that he was committed to a state authority that has the discretion to place him in the hospital or place him in an otherwise supervised situation for a continuous period of 20 years.
Well, what kind of facility was it? Again, this is Judge Greenberg. Who were his fellow inmates? Were they the civilly committed people or people who were committed in lieu of going to prison because they pleaded guilty to a crime?
I cannot answer that with confidence, Your Honor, but based upon the state system in Kansas that I'm familiar with, these individuals are placed in there with both persons who have criminal charges as well as people who do not. In other words, it is a state mental institution that is provided for the care and treatment of the mentally ill.
Well, should it make a difference? He wasn't free to leave the facility without permission, was he?
No, he was not, Your Honor, but that's not a condition precedent to the statute. The conditions precedent in the statute relate only to whether or not the veteran was or was not incarcerated for the conviction of a felony.
And you think there's some dispute as to that?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. The only thing that is in this record is pages 797 to 799. And in that document, there is no reference to, I take it that's my 3-minute warning. That there is no reference to the term convicted of a felony or the term incarcerated. And it seems
I understand your argument. Thank you.
Yeah.
This is Judge Peach. Let's add 5 more minutes to the appellate argument.
That was just my 3-minute warning. I'm sorry, Your Honor. That was just my 3-minute warning, as I understood it.
That's correct. So that means you have 3 minutes left on your 20 minutes of argument. So I propose that we add 5 more minutes to your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And I do have a question. It's slightly not on point, but I'm curious about this. During the term of his incarceration in the mental institution, was Mr. Philbrook service-connected for anything?
Yes, he was, Your Honor. And as a matter of fact, the record reflects that he got an increase in his service-connected condition for his scheduler rating, and I believe went to a combined 70 or 80% rating for his service-connected conditions, and I believe an additional service-connected disability for headaches was in fact acted upon.
And was he receiving the total amount of that service connection compensation during that period?
He was, Your Honor, and we believe that that is further evidence that the C provision of 5313 does not apply because the Secretary took no action under 1513A to reduce his benefits while he was in the mental institution. And therefore, that would seem to me to be evidence that the government did not treat this as having been incarcerated for a felony. It's important to remember, Your Honor, that the Secretary, when he received this TDIU application, made a decision on the merits. It was not until it got to the board that the board sua sponte made an interpretation of 5313C to determine that as a matter of law, he was precluded from entitlement to a TDIU rating.
Thank you.
I think you ought to go ahead, Mr. Carpenter.
I will. I was just trying to find my place in my notes. Okay. If I could direct the court's attention back to the record at pages 797 to 798, we believe that the language used in there is all qualified terminology. For example, it says that Mr. Philbrook committed acts alleged to constitute crimes, constituting the crime of attempted murder. Further, that he would have been found guilty of a felony conviction. Third, that he required commitment to a state hospital, but not incarceration in a federal, state, or other local penal institution or correctional facility. And the supplemental authority that we will be submitting later today indicates that the information in the statute suggests that if the, or not suggests, actually indicates that if the defendant is not found insane, that the judge shall sentence the defendant to a term of incarceration. And that, we believe, shows clear evidence of a legal distinction between incarceration and commitment to a state mental institution. And then finally, of course, the court ordered that Mr. Philbrook be placed under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board for his care, custody, and treatment. And care, custody, and treatment is not the purpose of incarceration for a felony conviction, and that it continues for a period not to exceed 20 years. So Mr. Philbrook was under or remains under the care, custody, and control of this state board for treatment of his mental illness. We believe that the as I indicated in response to one of Judge Greenberg's questions, that the meanings of the word in words incarcerated, the phrases penal institution, correctional facility, and the phrase conviction of felony are all unambiguous and cannot be read to include commitment to a state mental institution. Specifically, these words are not equivalent to the phrases used, to the language used in the stipulation that is of record. We believe that they unambiguously refer to the incarceration in a state or federal or other local penal institution for the conviction of a felony, which is not what happened in this case. Unless there are further questions, I'll reserve whatever minimal amount of time I have left.
Thank you. Judge Greenberg, do you have any questions?
Nothing else, Judge Peach.
Judge Toth?
Nothing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Kelly?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the court. Chandrette Kelly on behalf of the secretary, and with me is my deputy, Nicole Cottle. Court should hold that incarcerated as used in 5313C includes confinement in a state psychiatric hospital because to do so is consistent with congressional intent as provided in both GC opinions and the M21-1 and with Oregon state law. Under 5313C, secretary will not assign a TDIU rating to any veteran during any period in which the veteran is incarcerated in a federal, state, local, or other penal institution or a correctional facility for conviction of a felony. Appellant's confinement by court order to the Oregon State Psychiatric Hospital qualifies as being incarcerated in a penal institution or a correctional facility.
This is Judge Greenberg. May I just interrupt you for a minute? Could you describe what this facility actually was in Oregon?
Your Honor, based on my research into the hospital, the Oregon State Hospital is not open to the public. You can only go there by court order. There are people who are placed there based on civil commitments, but they are in separate programs from people who are placed there under the Oregon statute for guilty except for insanity, please.
So this would be similar to a state prison for the criminally insane?
Yes, Your Honor. The program that appellant was placed in would be yes.
So it is entirely restricted to the outside world. It's supervised by the state, and the persons who are sent there are not free to leave or to roam around at will.
To the best of my knowledge, that's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you. Go ahead.
The congressional intent as to 5313 is indeed silent as to the question of psychiatric hospitals. However, this court and the Federal Circuit have found that silence does not create ambiguity where congressional intent is clear. Citing the court can see my April 14th Rule 30B statement, which includes this court and the Federal Circuit's findings in Wallace v. Shinseki, which show that we do not find the statute to be ambiguous, and also noting that Congress intended to avoid wasteful expenditures of government resources. Any gap in Congress's choice of language is filled by Congress's explanation in enacting the statute and its actions thereafter, which would include a December 2006 amendment, which expanded the language of the statute to include or correctional facility. Congress's intent was to avoid duplication of federal expenditures, and 5313 limits the amount of VA compensation that may be paid to a veteran who is incarcerated for more than 60 days for conviction of a felony.
Counsel, this is Judge Peach. A follow-up on the question I asked Mr. Carpenter regarding Mr. Philbrook's service-connected compensation, did the secretary take any action to limit the payment of that pursuant to 5313 subsection A, parentheses A?
No, Your Honor, but we would consider that to be an accounting error on behalf of VBA that would be further compounded by any award of TDIU for the period by which he was incarcerated.
Thank you.
Go ahead. During his time at Oregon State Hospital, Oregon citizens charged $20,636 per month for appellant's care. At that time, he suffered no economic detriment as a result of his disability. This documentation is available in the record. It was not provided in the rope, but we can supplement if the court requests to do so. In this instance, a monthly TDIU payment would be an additional award of $3,106.04. And as noted, while he continued to receive his full benefits until November 2014 when his mother was appointed his fiduciary, that again would be an accounting error on behalf of VBA, which presently the secretary is not pursuing any overpayment for, given that error. Again, the intent in passing the statute makes no distinction between a publicly funded state psychiatric hospital and a public funded prison. The logic and intent is to avoid the public paying twice to cover the needs of one individual. Moreover, in the expansion of the language again in December 2006, Congress included the phrase or correctional facility. There's nothing to suggest that Congress intended the statute to be read narrowly or to exclude Badger Hospital.
Counsel, I have a question. You mentioned his monthly amount for TDIU. After he was placed in the halfway house, and he was determined to get that he qualified for TDIU, he was paid TDIU during the period beginning his residency in a halfway house.
Yes, Your Honor.
And does he pay for that? Does he pay for his room and board, so to speak, at this halfway house?
That I don't know the answer to, Your Honor. I would have to investigate that question further.
And did he pay for his room and board at the, while he was incarcerated in the psychiatric institution?
No, Your Honor. The state was charging $20,636 per month for his care, which was taken care of by state taxpayers. That documentation, again, is present in the record, but was not included in the pleading before, and I can supplement the ropes to include that.
Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to VA policy guidance regarding incarceration and correctional facilities, GC Opinion 5991 indicates that the purpose of disability compensation is to replace lost earning capacity and is necessary where a person, by reason of imprisonment, suffers no economic detriment as a result of a disability. That, of course, is binding on the board. As to the M21, the definition includes persons incarcerated in medical facilities as long as the individual is confined to the institution pursuant to a criminal sentence. Again, we have that here as based on the April 2011 order from Oregon Court. Additionally, Oregon state law would support VA's definition of correctional facility and incarceration. To clarify, Mr. Carpenter mentioned a statute 13502 parts B and E. In my research, that appears to be an Arizona statute, so it wouldn't apply to the matter before the court. The state law that we would be looking at would be a number of different Oregon statutes. 162.135 defines a correctional facility as a person being, one, confined under a court order, and two, covering application of the state hospital, assuming that the person has had an entry of judgment of guilty except for insanity, which is covered under Oregon Statute 161.325. Specifically, as to the placement in the hospital, that we covered under Oregon Statute 161.327, which indicates that commitment of conditional release or a person found guilty except for insanity of a felony would include incarceration in a hospital, needs the care and custody and treatment for the Psychiatric State Review Board, which is found in the order that we have before us in the record at 797-799. Again,
counsel, this is Judge Greenberg. Sorry to interrupt. You used the word Arizona. Did you mean Oregon?
I was referring to the statute that Mr. Carpenter referred to that he wants to add for his supplemental pleadings.
It's an Arizona statute?
13502 is an Arizona statute.
Well, I guess we'll hear from Mr. Carpenter when he argues again. So that was not a misstatement on your part. You're saying that Mr. Carpenter is relying on an Arizona statute, not an Oregon statute, assuming for the moment that even Oregon statutes are relevant.
Yes, Your Honor. And I recognize that with the our argument taking place as it is, it's a slightly different circumstance, but based on the fact that I am in front of my computer, I did look at 13502 on Westlaw, and it does indicate that is the Arizona statute.
All right, thank you. I got it. Go ahead with your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. So, again, Oregon law, with the court order confining appellant to the state psychiatric review board, testing and treatment qualifies as incarceration. And it's not binding on this court, but the court may find it to be instructional, and it is with VA's interpretation. The secretary asks that the court hold that incarcerated as used in 5313C and 3.341 include confinement in a state psychiatric hospital such that appellant is barred from entitlement to TDIU during his periods of confinement. However, the Secretary of
Defense... Counsel, this is Judge Toth. I want to ask. I know that no court has ever defined these terms as relates to 5313, but, I mean, these terms, conviction and incarceration, I mean, they appear in numerous federal statutes. Are there any instances in other statutes where courts have found interpretations that support yours that you're aware of?
Your Honor, not specifically as to state psychiatric hospitals, but if you look at the plain meaning of the word, Merriam-Webster defines incarcerate as subject to confinement, which is present here. When appellant was at the Oregon State Hospital, he was not released, and he was held there under a court order. Similarly, The definition of correctional facility would be a place where people are kept when they've been arrested or are being punished for a crime. Again, that's what we have here. This is not a civil commitment. He was found guilty except for insanity, and he was sent to the hospital to serve his time. So we believe that even with plain language, incarceration is possible.
Okay, so I'm gonna ask a hard pivot here, totally different question. I want to know your position on mootness. Is it your position that this case is moot since he got his TDIU benefits?
Your Honor, the issue of entitlement to TDIU is moot as the RO has already granted it. As noted in my Solzi notice, there was a March 24th, 2020 decision review officer decision which granted 100% and TDIU effective back to April 13th of 2018.
So is it your position still that the board's reading of 5313, you know, that someone in Mr. Philbrick's situation cannot receive it, that reading was correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks.
You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, the Secretary concedes that remand is warranted for the board to provide an adequate statement of reasons and bases regarding appellant's periods of confinement. Otherwise, we do believe that the DA's...
Wait a minute. Why would you concede that? You're here now. Don't we have to make a decision, put an end to this? We're asked to interpret the statute. The board did. We're asked to do it. Why would you concede that it should be remanded for the board to make a determination, and then it's going to come back here?
Your Honor, to the extent that the board found he was barred from entitlement during his confinement in the state psychiatric hospital as a matter of law, that question of law remains a viable for the court to address. However, the factual question as to the period of confinement are questions that the board must address in the first instance. In this case, as noted in our notice of change of position, there was a period of time, at least in 2013, where he was released from the hospital and into a group home that I had not previously seen during briefing. Because the board did not address that and said that he had been continuously incarcerated since 2009, we do believe that for the period of time to determine whether or not that was incarceration or not, they should have addressed whether or not he was entitled to TDIU based on the merit.
All right, I understand your position. Thank you.
If there are no further questions, thank you.
Judge Greenberg, any further questions?
No.
Judge Toth?
No, I don't, thanks.
Okay, no further questions here. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Carpenter?
Yes, may it please the court, Your Honor. Let me address the question of whether or not this is or is not an Arizona statute. Before I got on this call, this information was provided to me. I did not verify that it was from what state it was from. It uses the identical language of the statute in Oregon. This was my error in not verifying this. I will confirm what the Oregon statute does or does not say and submit that as supplemental authority. I obviously will not be submitting supplemental authority that deals with the state of Arizona. Let me next address the question of mootness. This issue is not moot. Judge Greenberg is correct that this matter is a question of law that was decided by the board, and Mr. Philbrook is entitled to a decision on this. Before the board's decision, He thought he was appealing the denial of IU. It was not until the board made a determination that as a matter of law, he was precluded from receiving TDIU under 5313C. Therefore, the secretary's notion that this is an effective date issue is simply incorrect. If the court finds that the board was correct in its interpretation, then the matter will have to be or will be ended at that point, that there will be no opportunity as a matter of law to get an earlier effective date for the periods in which he was committed to the Oregon State Hospital. The next question that I'd like to address is the question of whether or not there is or is not evidence in this record of the conviction of a felony. What the government is asking this court to do and what the board did was to make an inference based upon the statement in the stipulation, which does not contain the phrase convicted of a felony. The only reason that the provisions of 5313C apply is because there is incarceration based upon the conviction of a felony. Once released from his commitment to the Oregon State Hospital, the VA agreed, notwithstanding the fact that he is under the care, custody, and control of the state of Oregon, for supervision for a full period of up to 20 years. Mr. Philbrook did not pay for his care, but the state of Oregon, in my experience, states have brought actions against the incarcerated veteran, a committed veteran to a state hospital for the cost of their care. So the notion that he was not paying for his care would have been paid for if the state of Oregon had asked a court to determine whether or not, based upon his receipt of benefits.
Well, just a minute, Mr. Carpenter. This is Judge Greenberg again.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did Oregon ask for this payment?
To the best of my knowledge, they did not, Your Honor.
Well, isn't that an important fact?
Well, the government has asserted that this applies because he was not being charged for his care. The question is not whether he was being charged for his care, but whether or not he could have been charged for his care.
Well, isn't the question really whether his care was paid for entirely by Oregon, and why should the United States taxpayer pay him additional monies during that period of, I'm going to call it, because I don't think there's any doubt about it, incarceration? The question for us is that the kind of incarceration contemplated by Congress in this statute?
And there is nothing in the plain meaning of the statute to suggest that. These are two completely separate types of proceeding. It is a proceeding that results in incarceration if the plea is not successful, and a commitment to a state hospital if the plea is successful. And what this court would have to be doing is legislating the intent of Congress to find that commitment to a state hospital is something that is included as incarceration. And that, I believe, goes beyond what the rules of statutory construction contemplate with the plain meaning of a statute.
And but how critical, this is Judge Tother, I want to follow up on Mulder, and I'll give you some of the facts just if you don't have it in front of you. But there, you know, they're trying to figure out when the 60 days begins, right? And there's a dispute between whether it's when the person enters and they're effectively under a bail statute, not the criminal sentence, right?
Right.
And the Federal Circuit said, even though the person could, if they had been able to pay the bail, but they believe they're not technically, like, that's not a technically a conviction in the sense of the person has, you know, when you have your bail hearing, you don't have your rights fully adjudicated. But the Federal Circuit said that doesn't really matter. That's still, for our purposes, a conviction under 5313. How is that different from what you're arguing?
Because the circumstances in Mulder involved a conviction of a felony. There is no evidence in this record that Mr. Philbrook was convicted of a felony. And this court cannot, as the board did, read into the statute a factual finding that there was a conviction of a felony if there is no evidence in the record of such a conviction.
Right, but the bail, like the date at which they started applying 5313 began with effectively what would have been a bail statute, right? I mean, the point is they haven't kind of hewed to the most formal reading of conviction. You know, the Federal Circuit's a superior court to us,
yes.
Right? And their point was that even though the bail statute itself is not, in a sense, you know, the person pleaded no contest, you know, so they didn't admit guilt, but they pleaded guilty. And they said that basically because a sentence was attendant to the bail statute, that's how they should sort of figure it out. And that's kind of where I was going my line of questioning earlier, that about the fact that there was a sentence attached to, you know, his confinement in this mental facility. They couldn't just sort of sentence him to like a week in the mental facility and then he could get released.
Well, I'm not sure I quite follow that, Your Honor. I think it's apparent from the language of the order that he could have been released if the court had found that his mental condition was not so severe as it required commitment to the state hospital.
Right. And in the case of Mulder, he could have been released if he could have paid $750,000. The point is, to the Federal Circuit, that the fact that he could have been released was not material. And the fact that, you know, the conviction was under a bail statute or under something that was less than a fully kind of Sixth Amendment criminal conviction didn't sway them.
Except, Your Honor, and I do not have Mulder in front of me, but my recollection is that Mulder was eligible for bail on a revocation of parole, and that that was the distinction in Mulder because he had already been convicted of a felony, was on parole, and was subject to a parole violation and was entitled to bail based upon that parole violation, as I recall the facts. Now, I may be misremembering those facts, but if those are the facts, then that is clearly distinguishable because in this circumstance, there is no pre-existing felony conviction. I will look Mulder up.
I understand your position. I mean, in that case, they did not contest the fact that a no contest plea was not a conviction. You are contesting qualitatively what constitutes a conviction. So I understand your difference.
And I'm not only contesting it, Your Honor. I'm asserting that the board has no factual basis in the record to support its finding of fact.
Well, and what about a stipulation? A stipulation exists for that purpose.
This is Judge Peach. Let's add two more minutes, please. Thank you. Go ahead, Judge Toth.
With respect, Your Honor, I do not believe that it does because there is no evidence of a conviction within the four corners of the three pages of that document. It does not speak in terms of, as a result of this plea, the court convicts Mr. Philbrook of a felony.
Right, yeah, that's when you pointed to that conditional language.
Yes, and without unequivocal language of the conviction of a felony, there is not the underlying factual basis to trigger the operation of the statute. And the government is essentially asking this court to make fact-finding in the first instance that there was a felony conviction. Judge Greenberg's point on incarceration being the same as commitment is independent of the predicate for both, which is a conviction of a felony or a finding that the person's mental disease or defect requires their care, custody, and control by the state of Oregon. And those are factually different. One triggers the provisions of 5313, the other one does not. Unless there's further questions from the panel.
Judge Greenberg, any questions?
Nothing further.
Judge Toth?
No, thank you to both parties.
Thank you. And I have no further questions. Thank you very much, both counsel. The case will be submitted for decision, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is in
recess.
The
court is in recess.